St. George's number one station with Washington County's top talk show. The Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Hey, good morning, 909 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thank you for tuning in today. It's weird. I'm so used to the sun streaming in the studio this time of morning, but with our cloud cover, we got no sun streaming in the studio. But we do have David Blodgett streaming in the studio. Dr. Blodgett, our health official here in town, Southwest Utah Public Health. Dr. Blodgett, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it, man.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Andy.
It is a couple of things on my mind, and then we'll get into, I think, the main topic. Number one, allergy season. Holy smokes, I see sniffling and sneezing and itchy eyes all over town, and I finally broke down yesterday and went and bought some Flonase. But Maybe you can explain that some of the allergy medicine, things that work and things that don't necessarily work for someone who's suffering from the itchy eyes, itchy watery eyes, and that kind of thing. You have any ideas on how we can battle it?
Yeah, well, it's that time of year, and it gets worse every year.
It does, it seems like.
It's interesting because people say, well, I didn't used to have allergies, and then I moved away and came back. You know, it's a fascinating landscape, and I, this time of year really gets me, so I've got the whole
you got the allergies too?
As well. Yeah. And unfortunately, the thing that works the very best is the thing that nobody wants to use. So Benadryl works, like, you know, the old medicines work, but unfortunately they shut everything down, right? So you're sleepy and groggy.
I was going to say, I take Benadryl and I'm done for the day.
So not very many people try that very often. I actually think for a lot of people, Claritin and Zyrtec, some of those in the middle, they kind of act on the same mechanism without the drowsy side effects. And so That's kind of where it works for me.
Had a few people recommend to me Flonase. Is that something, is that pretty sharp thing to use?
Well, so then for others, you can get into kind of a topical steroid kind of a thing that helps that decrease the inflammation in the lining of your respiratory tract there. So it's not a systemic steroid. So kind of that's the ultimate thing where you get like a Kenalog shot or something, you know.
Right.
It decreases inflammation throughout your system. But all of that can have its own side effects for some people. And, you don't really want to be on steroids your whole life. That's kind of something we try and avoid. So the thought is, well, if you can do them topically as a spray, like a Flonase or Nasonex or one of that class of medications, that's better than taking systemic steroids. But, you know, for some people, the Kenalog is kind of the last step, and probably once or twice a year isn't nearly as damaging as taking steroids all the time, you know, for some people.
So if I take a couple of squirts of Flonase, I'm technically I'm on steroids.
Yeah, well, sort of. It's different than the on steroids of an athlete.
Would I fail one of those tests, maybe?
No, those are anabolics. They're different.
Okay.
Steroids are... they're hormones, right, and have different mechanisms of action. And so the anabolic steroids you're referencing are a whole different class.
All right. So I wouldn't fail a test. Right.
No, you wouldn't fail any tests. But
I could use some time off if they.
Yeah.
You know, if the boss wanted, well, you're suspended for
two
weeks.
That's the kind of with time pay. Off you want.
with pay. But no, yeah. Okay, I understand.
And then there are people that go to the extent, and it's becoming more popular to do some sort of a sensitization where you slowly expose yourself to those antigens they are that make you have those responses, and there's been a lot of success with that. So that particularly for people that have a life-threatening allergy like peanuts or something like that's a really a valuable contribution to the field that's fairly new. So
is that a similar concept than we see with vaccinations, where you exposed to a little bit of it?
Similar, right? Yeah, except for it's little teeny amounts for a long period of time.
Okay.
I've seen dramatic results where people that would have an anaphylactic response to peanuts can now be around peanuts and not, you know, have to worry. So, interesting. It's an interesting field, specialists in medicine. That's what they do is try and help people navigate the when your own body is not performing the way you want it to. Sometimes that's the worst of
for sure
diseases. That's the whole autoimmune spectrum, and but it starts with allergies.
We found out my youngest daughter is allergic to tomatoes, of all things.
Oh wow!
And I don't know that I know anybody that's allergic to tomatoes, but they did, you know, the scratch test, and she kept getting upset stomachs when she would eat, you know, pizza or whatever. It has seemed like everything has tomatoes in it, you know, some kind of tomato sauce in it, hot sauce and barbecue sauce and ketchup and all those things, and she kept getting sick. And then they finally did the scratch test and said, yeah, you really shouldn't eat tomatoes. It's going to make you sick every time.
I don't think I've ever heard of that before. But
yeah, it's a new one.
There's always something.
Now she doesn't live with us anymore, but when she comes to visit, I have to be, you know, I'm usually the food preparer. I have to be conscious, okay, does this have tomatoes or does this not have tomatoes?
Right.
And it's one of those deals that you have to weigh, like you were talking about, side effects. And for her, the side effects, she's going to get really sick if she eats tomatoes. Every once in a while, she'll have something with tomato anyway because it's so good. But
right.
Kind of like those with an intolerance to dairy.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to have an ice cream cone.
Sometimes you just think it's worth it. Huh?
Yeah.
That's hard to have pizza and pasta not on the menu anymore,
though. Yeah. Well, I guess there's always Alfredo or something.
I guess I don't know.
So I wanted to ask you, so the heart, I mean, obviously heart disease is number one. It's a killer. But there's so many different aspects of that. I actually got a notification twice in the last week that my heart rate had dipped below what they consider normal. While I was sleeping, 38 beats per minute. And it's cool. I have this Apple Watch, and it can notify me of these things. And it says, if this keeps happening, contact your doctor. But I have a doctor here, Dr. Blodgett. I'm curious, is that something that someone should be concerned about, a slower heart rate?
Sometimes, I mean, if it's symptomatic, so you're lightheaded and things like that, or mm-hmm. if you have an abnormal rhythm that's causing that, which needs to be looked at, it can be. So maybe just on a periodic basis like that, it's not that big a deal. And some people just kind of live there. They have if you're super athletic and things like that, that'll lower your heart rate. So
I've always had a very low heart rate.
It's always in context. But
this was 38 years ago, when I got my physical to go on a mission, my heart rate, resting heart rate, was 52, and the doctor was really concerned. He said, "Now, do you do a lot of sports?" I said, "Yeah, I play basketball like 5 times a week." And he's like, "Okay, I'm not worried anymore, because when you do a lot of sports, it does slow your heart rate down."
Yeah, but as you get a little older, and you know, sometimes people need a little kick to keep their heart beating at an appropriate rate. But that's a matter for your doctor.
Yeah. My mom had a pacemaker because she had a slower heart rate.
Yeah.
She had to have one put in. So
it's not uncommon. Fast and slow, either way.
All right. Wanted to talk today a little bit. There's a couple of great stories online. And I don't say great because they're great news, but stories that kind of help bring things to light. And I wanted to read a couple of them to you. First of all, I thought this was pretty big. The U.S. Surgeon General is calling loneliness a public health crisis. The U.S. Surgeon General says that even before COVID-19, about half of all adults said they were experiencing loneliness every single day. Loneliness can raise the risk of premature death by 26% and social isolation by 29%. On a day where we don't have sunshine, I hate to get depressed and bummed out about things, but loneliness is a real thing. And, you know, when we go back to COVID, you know, okay, restaurants are closed, stores are closed mostly, and we were told to stay home. And, you know, for me, I had my two daughters and my wife at home, and staying home was not a big deal. I had that family, you know, unit there. But there were a lot of people, when they were told to stay home, there was no one there for him.
It had a definite negative impact. You know, when you look down the charts of rates of death, there was those that died from COVID, but then almost every cause of death increased over COVID.
Wow.
And some would want to say, well, that's just undiagnosed COVID, and I would argue it's not, because we did a really good job of, you know, detecting COVID. It's that... we had some of these other factors creep in that were, you know, access to health care. You just couldn't get into the doctor because everything was swamped with COVID.
Yeah.
and then this issue of loneliness. So, I mean, I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. The single most verifiable impact on health, if you want to know what will determine whether somebody lives another 8 or 10 years in their life, is whether or not they are married.
Wow.
Have a significant other that's that committed to them in their life. And so I think it gets to this issue of you reinforce good habits in each other. You reinforce positivity and reasons for doing things that are proactive and out there and, you know, exercising, all of those kind of things. They also say it's helpful to have a dog, right? Because the dog spurs you to get out and walk a little bit and
even helps with the loneliness thing too.
So it definitely is a true indicator of on that continuum of things that can contribute to good health, having the association of people that you love and respect and that love you is really a critical thing. And that also gets into they've demonstrated that people that have a religious background, a close community of people that they get to and have a common purpose behind what they do, also have a longer lifespan.
Big factor.
Because it gives them a format in which that loneliness can be alleviated. So,
you know, if I were to, in my current situation, if I were to take, you know, the emotional support side of things that my wife provides, I think about some of the nuts and bolts, and you touched on them a little bit, but I might have a weird growth on my arm, or I might have a weird slowed heartbeat or something, and I might go, no big deal, I'll just deal, it's fine.
Right.
But when you have a spouse there who says, you know, that actually worries me, how about we make an appointment for you? And I still, some of us still are like, nah, you don't need to. But then they make the appointment and you go because they did that for you. And I mean, just the again, kind of the everyday thing, that, like you said, spurring to go exercise. I mean, you want to be in better shape and live longer for your spouse. I mean, some of those things that you don't even really think about that much, but they're huge.
Yeah, well, think about eating, right? Are you likely to put the effort in to make a nice meal that's got a fruit and vegetable included and stuff when it's just you, or are you just more likely to say, I'll just grab a something, you know?
Burger on the way home, yeah, or something.
So yeah. There's certain things that always come through when you're trying to figure out, you know, what determines health, and, you know, this idea of a sense of attachment and togetherness, you know, is key in mental health as well as physical health. We talked about sleep. That fits into that. Exercise, eating your fruits and vegetables, all of that fits this milieu of what creates longer and better health. And some of us are lucky that we have all of those pieces in place, and some are not. And it really is... it's a more complicated picture than we want it to be sometimes.
But. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, but I'm curious, when you were a young doctor, you're at Johns Hopkins, and you're thinking about going into the public arena as far as public health, did a lot of this mental and emotional stuff enter into your studies back then, or is this something that's more common now that we're becoming more aware of it now than we did 10, 20 years ago?
No, you know, I think it's, I think there's been good research on this all the way along. It's just, some of these factors were kind of baked into society, right? And so you could say, look, this is pretty obvious, this is helpful. Mm-hmm. And just over the last 20 or 30 years, we've lost some of that, right? This idea that it's a good thing to exercise every day or be married or have a good, tight social network. You know, those kinds of things have not been what society's keyed on. And when you think it's all about individuality and rejecting cultural norms and stuff like that, there is this price I think we pay, you know, as a society.
How much more has mental health entered into your job now as a public health official in recent times? I mean, depression and anxiety seem to be at an all-time high, and we can blame some of that on COVID, of course, but we can also blame some of it on social media and the way we use our phones and computers. But is it becoming, I mean, they just talked about loneliness being an epidemic. Is mental health becoming more of a factor?
Well, I certainly think so. When we do assessments of the community, we call them community health assessments to mm-hmm. try and identify the factors that we should be focusing on as systems, right, as a whole community system engaged in health. And, you know, so we meet with the hospital and the behavioral health folks, and we talk to people in the community and try and get an idea of what's on their mind. Consistently, the last 2-3 community health assessments we've done, the number one issue that everybody identifies as the biggest problem is mental health issues. And and so I think we're seeing that in areas where most parts of society were living longer, right? We're doing better. But then there's demographics, particularly, you know, white males, 25 to 45, where the numbers are headed in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And they you know, they call them deaths of despair. So I think related to substance abuse.
That's the number one suicide, demographic for suicide. Yeah.
And so I think people are recognizing that this is an area where there's a lot of difficulty, and yet there just aren't enough resources, and there never will be enough resources from the community to deal with that, right? The factors that build resilience in people, that some of the things we need to, you know, we need to be supportive of each other. We need to help each other out. We need to have social networks, all of those kinds of things. And so you throw social media in there where it tends to isolate people even more. Some of the protective factors we've had in society historically are really not there for people.
Such as?
The social connectedness that we've felt, the sense of community, of identity with something bigger than yourself.
Can any of that social media replace it or be a little bit of an extension of that? You have the neighborhood community. I live in Middleton. We have a Middleton neighborhood page, and we have, you know, for the church group, I mean, the ward I'm in, there's a ward page. So it's easy for us to pick off, you know, social media saying how terrible it is. But I would think that if you are, say, an older person who doesn't have a spouse living alone, social media in some ways could help. Yeah.
I don't think that it's universal to say it's bad. I just think you have to be careful that it doesn't separate you from the other things that make life good, right?
Use it as a
driver, not a distractor from that, you know?
Okay,
So when the dropout rates from college have increased recently, when they tried to figure out what was the cause of that, you know, it boiled to the top.
What's that?
Too much time on social media. So I think you have to be, it's a new tool of part of life that you have to, just like everything else, you have to figure out the balance and the where it fits into your overall scheme, instead of more is better is not true for anything, right?
Yeah,
So I just think it's the newest toy on the block, and you just have to be careful to recognize that it's part of life, but it's not all of life, and sometimes you don't realize that until it's too late. You've kind of neglected things to the point where they can't be fixed. You know,
so. I have a relative who teaches college, and she said something about cell phones bothering, you know, they were such a distraction in class. And I said, well, can't you require your kids to, you know, no phones in class, period? Can you make that rule? And her response was basically, if I did that, they wouldn't come to class anymore. I mean, you talk about the dropout in college. People have become so attached to their phone, it's so important to them that they would rather, like you said, maybe drop out of college or just not go to class or whatever if they can't have their phone with them.
Well, and it's really interesting. You know, so I remember I'm old enough to remember that when you would call somebody and leave a message, you'd expect a call back within, you know, a day or two, right? I mean, that was just kind of the, you know, call somebody's secretary and she'd pass the message on, it take a day or two to get me. But that really is not the expectation now. We expect immediate pickup from somebody on their cell phone, and it's created a whole different societal expectation of what that means. And so that's part of the reason that our phones are attached to us, is there's that expectation that we'll get back to people.
Immediacy. There, it's interesting now. If you call someone and they don't answer their phone, at this point, you've got a couple of choices. You can leave a message, which I don't think a lot of people do anymore on their voicemail, or you can hang up, either call them right back, and maybe they didn't get to it in time, or you can send them a text message. Either way, you expect, like you said, just about immediate response, like within a few minutes. Otherwise, they even have a word if you don't do it. They call it ghosting if you don't do it.
Fairly immediate gratification of that desire to hear from them, right? And it's not reasonable. And so I remember they used to warn when I was a kid in school. They used to say, look, the phone is supposed to be for your convenience, not for everybody else's convenience into your world. And I think, I don't know that anybody ever thinks about that anymore.
It's true. It's true. And it's so funny because in the business world, so when I you know, from when I get off the air at 10 a.m. till about 2 or 2:30 or 3, I'm doing business. I'm contacting people. I'm setting up guests. I'm arranging sales meetings and things like that. And I do expect, as I you know, make my way through this business world, that people are going to get back to me. And when someone doesn't get back to me, okay, if they don't get that back to me like immediately, that's cool. I'm okay with that. If it's an hour, I'm still pretty okay with that. But if I text someone a question and they don't get back to me for 3 or 4 hours, I'm not very happy. I mean, it's like, hey, I'm trying to, you know, and a lot of times I'll be working on, say, a story for our website, and I need a source to get back to me. They don't get back to me 3 or 4 hours. I'm like, I'm kind of put out. I'm like, well, I already published the story. You missed it. You know what I mean? And it's terrible. I don't want to feel that way. I'm like you. Back in the day, if you heard from someone a day or two later, that was good.
Yeah.
It's not that way anymore.
It's interesting. And I think it's for our kids even bigger pressure, and they don't want to ever be away from their phone because they're afraid they'll miss something, right? And
oh, the old FOMO, right?
Sense that, you know, what exactly have you missed, right? What is it that sometimes we allow the urgent to overtake the important?
That's true.
And that's, I think, become even bigger issue with the phone. So,
well, it's even that way.
Sometimes I'll deliberately not have my phone on for a few hours.
That's a good idea.
Just to let it seep.
Well, it's even that way with television now. Instead of waiting, okay, my program's on at Friday night at 7 o'clock or Tuesday at 6:30 or whatever. We can now stream, you know, whatever we want, whenever we want, for the most part, and so we become impatient in the way we watch movies or the way we watch TV as well.
Yeah, I remember when you'd anticipate the release of the new movie and build it up.
Yeah. All right, got to get a break in here. We're with Dr. Blodgett today. He is the director of the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. Tomorrow, by the way, we'll hear from one of the guys that works for him, David Heaton, and he'll be on at 7:55 tomorrow morning. All right, we're going to get back into our discussion about end of life and loneliness and that kind of stuff. But let's take a minute and talk about diabetes a little bit. Dr. David Blodgett is with me today from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. And diabetes is, I don't think it's inflammatory or maybe fanatical to say it is a modern epidemic.
Yep.
It is, you know, the fact that, and it's not type 1, it's type 2 diabetes. And the fact that Americans aren't stopping it.
Yeah. You know, my professors, when I went to college, talked about a day when if you had somebody come in with diabetes, it was a big deal. They'd
know
everybody go see it, you know, because they just didn't see it. But then by the time I went to medical school, they were starting to say it's more prevalent than it's ever been. It was 1 or 2% of the population. Now, 10%. 10% of the population 10%. Diabetic, probably 25 or 30% pre-diabetic. You know, so about 25% of those that are pre-diabetic will convert to diabetes. So let me put it this way. The estimates from the Congressional Budget Office are that healthcare costs will double over the next 20 years.
Wow.
And most of that doubling of costs will be related to diabetes. Hmm. So this one disease now accounts for 25% of the healthcare dollar.
Wow.
And will probably account for 50 to 60% over that time period. And so it is not just an individual problem, it's a societal problem, but for you, for those that have diabetes, it becomes life-altering, right? You've now you have much higher risk of a wide variety of different ailments. It impinges on your personal life and everything that you're able to do in your life. And so it's an issue that we'd like to really make a push on in the health department, raise awareness that it's also true that probably 60-70% of people that are pre-diabetic and half of people that are diabetic don't know they are. So we're having two pushes. One is this month we're highlighting the fact that we have low cost testing, $25 to get an A1C just to see where you're at. You can go to our website and or come in, and we've got pre-screening tests where you can kind of go through and see where you fit on the risk scale.
Right.
And if you're high risk, you know, we'd like to have you take an A1C, and that'll give you a sense of where you're at if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic. And you know, in the pre-diabetic range is where you want to catch it so you can stop it. There, 60-65% of people can stop that progression.
It's from reversible.
Diabetes to diabetes. Okay. If you just do some pretty basic things in your life, it doesn't have to be nearly as impactful on your lifestyle and your life if you do it before you have diabetes and then after, right? And so this is where prevention can have a real impact. And so, you know, we like to think about screening for cancer and,
right,
you know, what that can do, but screening for diabetes and pre-diabetes is perhaps one of the most impactful things you can do to prevent that really devastating part of life for an increasing number of people. So
we use the word, it's kind of a catch-all word, it's lifestyle is the cause for it. But what does that entail? And I mean, specifically, maybe talk about reversing it. What does someone need to do if they're pre-diabetic or they feel like they're headed that way? Is it changing the way you eat? Is it exercising more? Is it just being plain more active? Is it, I mean, what are the main things that we've got to do?
Number one, be more active.
Be more active.
Yeah. So you, your activity level increases your sensitivity to insulin. It reverses all the processes that are headed in the wrong direction as you go through pre-diabetes to diabetes. Once you're diabetic, it becomes diet, perhaps. Probably because then you're trying to limit the amount of sugar that you can't process properly and that kind of thing. But even in that scenario, exercise still is really, really critical. So we're not talking, you know, I always have this mantra because people think, well, you need to run the Ironman in order to be healthy, and that's just not true. You know, half hour every day is the sweet spot, right? And if you can get out walking, ride your bike, a little bit of jogging, whatever it is that is your thing to be more active, it has a huge impact on your body's sensitivity to insulin, to all of the spectrum of what we call metabolic syndrome of, you know, increasing weight and high blood pressure. All of that kind of realm is very susceptible, very treatable, if you will, with lifestyle modifications. So food plays a big part in that as well. You know, we talk about those big four: maintaining a healthy weight,
sleep,
eating your fruits and vegetables. Yeah, and now sleep, we're adding to that as a real factor. So if you're not getting appropriate amounts of sleep, it's very difficult to maintain a healthy lifestyle. So
There was a story about Sleeper on the wire today, and I can't find it right now, and I'm not going to take the time to mess with it. But you and I have talked about it many times. Getting enough sleep is so crucial, and I'm an example, really, of for a while didn't get enough sleep, and it affected my health. I'm doing much better now.
Yeah, good.
Getting seven usually around, so between six and seven, but I used to get between four and six. So.
Oh, man.
We're headed in the right direction, at least.
Good. Well, I'm happy to hear that. So with this push on diabetes, we'll have a big, you know, outreach as far as all of our social media and stuff for diabetes, and then we'll shoot. In November is actually Diabetes International Diabetes Day and International and National Diabetes Month, and so that we'll actually have a screening event where we'll do this for free, and we'll, you know, have stuff in our magazine about it. So we really want to make sure diabetes is on people's radar. Along with that, we're going to have a special issue of our magazine that is all about sleep. So the health
That's
impacts
good.
Of not sleeping plus recommendations on how to do better with sleep. So watch for that. We're excited to have that coming up.
We're not going to do a big segment on sleep because we've done it before, but I did find the story. It was about sleep situations, and they actually named the worst, according to U.S. News and World Report, the worst cities to get a good night's sleep and the best cities. Ironically, two of the worst cities and one of the best cities are in California. San Diego was number one in the nation for getting a good night's sleep. But you go all the way to the other end, and these are towns that are cities that are over 100,000 people. But the two worst are also Fresno and Long Beach are in the bottom of the list. And San Diego, which is what, maybe 60 miles from Long Beach or something, is number one.
Yeah,
I don't know how that ranking works. I U.S. News World Report did, I think they did like 40 different metrics or whatever. But how important is getting the right kind of sleep? You know, a lot of people have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. A lot of people have noisy neighbors. I have to go to sleep, but if I'm going to get 7 hours, I have to go to sleep before 10 o'clock. I have to go to sleep like at 9:30.
Yeah.
Most people, I mean, regular people don't go to bed that early. Yeah. So, you know, there's some noise sometimes at 10 o'clock or at 10:30 in the neighborhood. You have things like noise pollution. You have light pollution. You know, how important is that stuff in getting good sleep?
So quality is also important. You can't derive the full benefits of sleep without getting the quality of sleep. And so most of the sleep scientists I've been reading say, look, with that in mind, you probably need to add an extra half hour to offset the times when you get up and, you know, rouse and go back to sleep and things like that. And boy, that those times when you just lay there and you're all stressed out, oh, I'm not sleeping. Those are problems. So so skill sets to deal with that are I think important too. So what they say is, if you're 10 or 15 minutes laying there stewing about stuff in bed, get up and do something else, and you know, something that helps you purge that and get tired again, and then come back to bed. So you're not allowing your brain to associate laying in bed as being an appropriate activity. So.
And again, one of the old rules, you know, your bed is pretty much for sleeping, maybe some other activities, but you shouldn't be watching movies in bed. You certainly shouldn't be eating in bed. You shouldn't be playing board games or whatever. That's a place to go where it kind of takes you away from the rest of the world and you go to sleep.
And it's a training issue for your brain. Your brain needs to say, this is where I sleep. And so cooling down the bedroom at night, less light, you know, more darkness, all of that has an impact. Even pets, you know, we like to have our pets around, but having them on the bed with you can cause trouble.
Okay, he's Dr. Blodgett. We're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about a really startling statistic. It has to do with suicide and age. You know, it is a tragedy when a young person takes their life, but they're not the only ones that are doing it. In fact, they're not the majority of the ones that are doing it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Dr. Blodgett in for his monthly appearance here on the Andy Griffin Show, here every first Wednesday of the month. He's been pretty darn reliable. I think maybe once or twice in 4 years where you couldn't make it. Other than yeah. that, you've been here.
Well, I try to make it a priority.
I think the times you couldn't make it, you called in or so. Maybe one time where you weren't actually at all even available.
Yeah.
So, pretty cool. Appreciate that.
I really appreciate the chance to be here, Andy. It's a great thing.
All right. I'm going to read something, and you already know these things, but I'm going to read it so our listeners can understand it and also so we can talk about it. I wrote a story yesterday. The title of the story, Southern Utah Alert, Suicide Among Older Adults is on the Rise. And you go 18 years ago, the suicide rate in the state of Utah was 15 per 100,000. Now it's over 20 per 100,000. You say, well, that, you know, per 100, that's not very much. Well, still, when you consider that, that's a huge, five more people are dying by suicide in Utah over the last, from 18 years ago. And then this one, men age 75 and older have the highest suicide rate compared to all other age groups. We're talking under 18, 18 to 24, 24 to 35, et cetera, et cetera. Men age 75 and older have the highest suicide rate, 42.2 per 100,000. That's according to the National Council on Aging. I think we need to, used to be you didn't talk about suicide because people really believe that it promoted suicide, but I think we got to talk about this. It's real.
It is real, and I don't, you know, the headline grabbing ones are the young people.
Right.
But like you say, that's actually, and as a, on their overall list of things you die from, that's pretty high up there because they just don't die from a lot of things, right?
Yeah, it's like third in Utah or something like that for young people.
Yeah, but by far the largest number, most frequently seen scenario is in this elderly male category, and it's worrisome, right? I mean, you get to a point, maybe something bad's happened in your life. You think you're old anyway. What am I hanging around for? But it has a huge impact on the families around them and on society in general. We need the wisdom those people represent, and so I'm saddened by that, and I don't think we have great answers on how to find them.
The list of reasons why a male, but not just males, but why elderly people do it is loneliness, number one. We talked about that earlier in the show. Grief, usually because I'm thinking they lost a spouse or someone very close to them. They also, money concerns and health concerns. You know, there's a story in Vermont about how they're really giving more accessibility to people who are dying, who have been diagnosed with a deadly disease, to go ahead and, you know, do it a little sooner, have the drugs that would finish them off. I don't want to make, you know, the old tempest in the teapot, right? This is important. Am I making too much of it? Is it okay if a guy who's, you know, 79 and has been diagnosed with cancer kills himself? Should we be okay with that?
I think if you start with the premise that life is sacred and we should have the capacity to live it to its fullest, I think it's easy to answer that question. And but it highlights some, you know, hypocrisy in our society as we talk through that. But but I think also there is this sense or this obligation we have to say there shouldn't be that kind of scenario for somebody, right? We should be able to help them in their hour of need. They've probably raised families and done great things in their sphere of influence and have, you know, impacted many lives. And then to feel that they don't contribute, you know, there's that old Maslow hierarchy of needs you learned in your psychology class, and that, that last stage is generativity versus shame and doubt. And I hate to think of people in my life that wouldn't feel that they're appreciated and valued in their declining times. There is a different side of this, and that's kind of the opposite, where people insist that you keep somebody alive as long as possible. And, you know, so we have a hard time balancing anything in our society.
We go to
extremes on almost everything, and we have to be willing to say we've done enough at some points, and we need to do more on other times.
I think one of the things we need to remember, too, and you can maybe talk about this, but just because they're 75 or 80 or 85 or 90 doesn't mean they've stopped feeling emotionally. That doesn't mean right. they're mentally – they're just an old guy. doesn't matter anymore. It still matters. You know, loneliness and grief, those are emotional things. And of course, suicide is an emotional act, but these are emotional things that need to be addressed, not by giving them extra drugs or not by, you know, all these different means, even a better diet. But these are things that we need to address as human beings and go up to these people and embrace them and understand. You know, I have a friend who is a young person. And they're like, oh, I'll do anything for autistic or whoever. I just don't like to be around old people.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's actually kind of common. I've heard people say that.
We're not an old people friendly society. You go to places, you know, Japan, China, where they venerate and revere their older people. It's the opposite. Well, and maybe helping them understand the resources that are available to them is key too. Mm-hmm. Right? We have wonderful resources here. The aging components of county government. You've got the senior center with stuff going on continuously. You know, there's things that can be done to help, and we just need to be aware of that and willing to reach out and help a neighbor in need.
Some of the warning signs that the National Council on Aging talks about, if an older person is giving away something that's important to them, that might be one of those signs. Like, why would you give this away now when it's so important to you? Things like daring or risk-taking behavior, sudden personality changes, alcohol or medication misuse or abuse, or even talk about suicide and about why am I even here? What's the point? These are all warning signs of things that we need to step up.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't think it speaks well of somebody that knows of somebody in that kind of situation that won't try something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. We talk, you know, and Dr. Blodgett is a medical, official here in the area. We talk about all the medications and all the masks and whatever else we need to do to be healthy. But sometimes it's just a matter of taking a couple of minutes and talking to someone.
Connectedness is such a sweet part of life, valuable part of life. And we, you know, isolating and allowing people to not interact the richness of life is lost in some of that.
Yeah, good point, folks. So I guess, I mean, I don't want to be preachy, but I'm saying, hey, let's reach out to people. If you see someone who's lonely, or it doesn't have to be a homeless guy. It doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to go visit nursing homes. Just if you see someone that could maybe use a friend or someone to talk to, it really is that simple to save someone's life.
They're in your neighborhood. They're your neighbors. They're your family members. They're not a mystery to you. It's just trying to, we're in this increasingly busy time of life or part of life or time in society, I guess. And I think sometimes the best rewards come when we figure out how to take ourselves out of that crazy busyness and focus on what's really most important to us.
He's Dr. Blodgett again. The diabetes screening, $25, right? Go to the health department, $25. You can find out if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, and it could save your life, literally. Make a couple of few tweaks.
Yeah, if you find out. I think it's much more going into, you know, like the lab, but we're happy to have you come down. Give it a shot.
All right. The website, swuhealth.org. That's the website to find more about diabetes testing. And again, reach out to someone. It's really not that hard. Reach out to someone if they need someone to talk to. Thank you, Dr. Blodgett, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.